Welcome to Naturally Nourished, a food is medicine podcast that delivers cutting-edge information and solutions for optimal health. Allie Miller is a nutrition expert sought out by the media and America's top medical institutes for her revolutionary functional medicine interventions. From disease treatment to prevention, every episode will empower you with ways to put yourself back in control of your health. Please note, the topics discussed are for educational purposes only and should not be used in place of any medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment from a licensed health professional. Now welcome your host, Allie Miller, integrative dietitian and owner of Naturally Nourished, and her vice president, integrative dietitian Carly Vogler.
Hello, welcome to episode 35 of the Naturally Nourished podcast. This is Allie Miller, and although we do not have my co-host Carly Vogler today, we do have two awesome guests that I can't wait to introduce, Dr. Lorenzo Cohen and Robin Haddad from MD Anderson Cancer Center. Today's topic is going to be on integrative oncology, and they're going to talk to you about the research study that I was involved in the development of using a bunch of different lifestyle therapies to work in conjunction with stage 2 and stage 3 breast cancer treatment through radiation. And they are both going to speak to you on their background, the role of oncology care, and how integrative medicine fits. And the study itself, which is in its 3.5 years into the study, and the process there, the barriers that they've hit, and best of all, the success stories that have been found. So today's topic is going to be really interesting. Definitely going to get into the details of that study and then some general elements on oncology. And one thing I want to make sure you all are familiar with is the concept of epigenetics. And I've spoke to this concept. It's a little bit in Allie Miller RD, my website, but this is one of my most empowering and favored scientific theories. And this is on the role of what occurs beyond the level of genetics, lifestyle factors such as toxicity, diet, stress, mindfulness, and physical activity, and how those types of different elements influence your body, not only on a biomarker level, not only on an energy level and a symptom associated level, but all the way down to the level of your DNA. And this study that Dr. Lorenzo and Robin will talk about in a moment was founded on the research of the book Anti-Cancer. And in that book, actually, they segregate nature and nurture as drivers of cancer diagnosis. In fact, they take children that were adopted and they see a stronger correlation of diagnosis of disease with their adopted parents than that of their genetic parents, which shows really the way that they were raised, their perception again of stress or success, that self-actualization, their diet, toxicity exposure in the household or their local environment, all played a stronger role in their development of disease or prevention of that. So epigenetics, it's an awesome concept that tells you that it's not just your genes. You don't just have bad genes, but it puts you back in the driver's seat of the vehicle of the car of your body. So no more writing that off. It's all about, this is what this podcast is about, empowering you and ensuring that you have the tools to create success, not just to treat disease, but to prevent it first and foremost, and to learn how to thrive versus simply survive. So before we get to meet Dr. Cohen and Robin, let's take a word from our sponsors. I'm really excited to tell you about some of the superfood ingredients available from Perfect Supplements. Gelatin is one of the highlights of their product line, and it's something that I use on a regular basis and love the fact that Perfect Bovine Gelatin is sourced from 100% pasture-raised, grass-fed, non-GMO cattle, with no hormones, synthetics, or pesticides.
I agree. When I'm burnt out from bone broth, I really love making gelatin treats. The Perfect Bovine Gelatin is a really great way to go. My other favorite is when I travel, I take a couple of packets of the Perfect Hydrolyzed Collagen. I love the fact that they offer the single serving packets of 100% grass-fed collagen. It's made of 90% protein, tasteless, and completely dissolves in any liquid. I love adding it to my iced coffee in the morning when I travel. It's just easy. Maybe a splash of almond milk at the coffee bar in the airport, and it keeps me satisfied until I land and can get a balanced meal.
As a way to introduce Perfect Supplements to all of you guys in my audience, we have an exclusive coupon to share with you all for 10% off of any order. Visit perfectsupplements.com and enter the coupon code ALI10. That's A-L-I in caps 10 at checkout. And you'll save 10% on their whole product line, which includes superfoods, the collagen, aquatic greens, and more. Also, you can visit our podcast page and find the Perfect Supplements link under this episode, which will lead you to their whole line of superfoods.
The gelatin and collagen especially are great for gut restoration, which we've talked about in a couple of our episodes. So make sure to check it out and use code ALI10.
All right. So excited today to introduce my two very special guests. Again, we have Dr. Lorenzo Cohen, who is the Richard E. Haynes Distinguished Professor in Clinical Cancer Prevention and the Director of the Integrative Medicine Department at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. You may be familiar with his writings as a contributor to the Huffington Post, along with leading radio show interviews with his wife, Allison Jeffries, as a regular guest on KPFT's Open Journal, and Pat Greer's Ecology. Dr. Cohen is passionate about educating others on how to prevent cancer and maintain optimal health across the lifespan. Welcome, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And along with him today, we are also welcoming Robin Haddad, who has her master's in public health and epidemiology and doctorate candidate in health promotion and behavior science with focus on multiple behavior interventions. Robin has been at MD Anderson for the past 6 years and has played an integral role in the research study development for comprehensive lifestyle change. Welcome, Robin, as well.
Thank you, Allie.
So you guys gave me a mouthful in just an introduction, so I'm excited about what's about to unfurl with our conversations today. So tell all our listeners, this is episode 35, and I have it titled Integrative Oncology. Tell us a little bit about how you describe what is integrative oncology.
So integrative oncology is a subspecialty of the area of clinical care that we call integrative medicine. And so oncology, of course, bringing integrative medicine to the cancer world. And it's really a philosophy of how we treat patients. So going beyond just treating the cancer itself and treating the whole human being, the Academic Consortium for Integrative Medicine and Health, of which MD Anderson's a member and of which I serve as the vice chair, we really define integrative medicine as a practice that focuses on, one, the relationship between the patient and the practitioner, which we know has really been eroded by our current medical system, where you can only spend 15 or 20 minutes with the patient, so you really can't uncover what's going on with
them.
Very importantly, works on you know, the whole person and not just the disease. Critical that we follow the evidence, so it has to be informed by evidence, and then making use of all practitioners, approaches, and different disciplines to achieve optimal health and well-being. So, you know, with that said, it's really, again, this more philosophical approach, and we typically are working alongside our conventional medicine colleagues and providing to patients modalities that may not be part of the standard of care. Things that can help with symptoms like acupuncture or massage or mind-body practices, and then other areas that really just should be part of the standard of care, but we really leave patients on their own, which would be the areas we'll get into discussing in detail today, things like dietary counseling and exercise coaching, etc.
Excellent. And I know that you've contributed and led many research studies. And so you've mentioned some of the modalities such as acupuncture, movement. Let's talk through some of those other ones that are available. So you said massage. I believe you may have touched on stress management. I know that you've done things with music therapy. Tell me a little bit further on some of the different approaches that you've seen and the benefits of them.
Well, so within our Integrative Medicine Center, which is our clinical delivery center for integrative oncology, we have massage therapists, music therapists, acupuncturists, mind-body people, dietary counselors, and physical therapists, very importantly, a behavioral psychologist to help people engage in the behavior change that we're asking them to do for those who need to. And unfortunately, most of our society needs to. What we see from the evidence of things like yoga, meditation, music therapy, massage, and acupuncture in particular, and that's why we have those modalities, because there is very good evidence from clinical trials published in, you know, good peer-reviewed journals, is that they help with symptom control. First and foremost, they can actually prevent the onset of symptoms. So something like acupuncture delivered during radiation to the head and neck area help to maintain saliva flow throughout radiation and then beyond. Things like yoga have been proven to help reduce sleep disturbances, improve fatigue, reduce deterioration in quality of life while patients are undergoing treatment, and improve outcomes after treatments are over. Something like meditation has been shown to help treat the cognitive dysfunction that patients experience after the end of chemotherapy. So really, as you're hearing me describe the benefits, really helping to control the symptoms that cancer patients experience due to their cancer or due to the conventional treatments.
And I think what's excellent, beyond the management of the interventions of, like you said, potentially the radiation and the chemotherapy and helping to reduce side effects, it also can address that root cause. And I think that that's that duality or synergy that's really beautiful with the integrative medicine, and love that MD Anderson goes for the research-based focus, because all too often I think the patient is very confused and misled on what is a sound intervention and how they can get access to that. And so tell me a little bit, beyond the research studies, the Integrative Department of Medicine, how are those services offered for listeners that may have a family member going through cancer care? Do they have to be doing their full treatment program there, or can they come to meditation classes? How are those services provided?
So our center is technically open for anybody, as it's called, who are touched by cancer. Services like our group classes. So we have wonderful group classes of different forms of meditation, group music therapy, nutritional counseling. You don't have to be an MD Anderson patient, but we have seven individual one-on-one programs where you do need to be. So that would include acupuncture, massage, one-on-one music therapy, working with the psychologist or the dietitian, the physical therapist, and importantly, meeting with a physician who can help guide what the appropriate thing is for the patients to prioritize. The center is also open, importantly, for caregivers, and they can benefit from massage and many of the other group programs as well. So patients, MD Anderson patients, need a physician referral, just like they would to, you know, pulmonary or
sure,
cardiac.
Sure.
And then we'd see them and develop a plan, and typically would see them, you know, 3 months later to check in and refine things. We also bring a lot of these services to the bedside. So in particular, acupuncture, music therapy, the mind-body services to help with symptom control.
Excellent. And now, looking at oncology care today and what is offered, what do you feel are some of those greatest misses that are not being widespread in oncology care?
Well, one you know general area is what we've just been talking about, which is, you know, we have a lot of patients who are suffering from uncontrolled symptoms in our hospital and when they go home into their community, and not giving some of these other non-conventional modalities a try does the patients a huge disservice. So, you know, trying acupuncture and teaching somebody that yoga could help with their sleep problems, and, you know, perhaps better than conventional sleep medications with no side effects is a huge missing potential for patients. But even bigger area, I believe, or as big of an area of a missed opportunity is the teachable moment of somebody diagnosed with cancer and letting them know that what they eat, how they exercise, how they manage their stress, and the love and support that they can foster in their life is going to be very important in influencing their outcomes. And in fact, you know, the most important thing, of course, is to prevent cancer in the first place. And we know that lifestyle and behavior is going to influence your risk of cancer by at least 50%, some estimate upwards in the 60 or 70% of cancers are due to lifestyle choices that we make. And of course, that I can quickly summarize what those areas are, which is a big focus of what we do after somebody's diagnosed with cancer. Smoking, you know, get rid of tobacco. That's 30% of cancer. The area of energy balance, which of course includes a healthy diet, appropriate exercise, and reducing sedentary behavior, which together are going to help reduce excess weight, is attributable to, on average, 30% of cancer. And in some cancers, like endometrial cancer, it accounts for 70%. And then there's the virally mediated cancers, which can be due to risky sexual behavior, human papillomavirus, which is responsible for the majority of cervical cancer and many head and neck cancers. And then, of course, there's sun exposure and you know, sunburns, which is, you know, a main cause of melanoma. So, you know, these areas together are things that patients need to be educated on even after a diagnosis of cancer, because the evidence shows that individuals who are of a healthy weight, eating a healthy diet, exercising regularly, and managing their stress have better outcomes. They live longer and have a lower probability of recurrence of disease. And this is something that is just not part of the medical model, and it's not part of the medical model, not because of some nefarious reasons. It's just things that people aren't educated on. We are very much a pharmaceutically driven medical system. We as a society would prefer to look to a pill to block our stress hormones than to do half an hour of meditation every day. So it's almost like a collusion between the patients, the doctors, and big pharma, and somebody really needs to break that circle.
And that's the dance, is with lifestyle playing such a huge element of all of this. Lifestyle in the first place is what likely drove or at least exacerbated the condition, but it can also be the dynamic piece in changing and resolving. And I think the difference that's important for listeners to understand is that there are many ways to survive cancer or survive cancer care, but using these integrative modalities can beyond help you survive, they can help you to thrive and actually bring you to a better quality of life maybe than which you were at prior to diagnosis. And I think that that's a really interesting piece, is that can be a stone in your journey to re-identifying. One of my greatest mantras is redefine your relationship with food. And I think that a diagnosis of cancer can be a time to recalibrate or readjust and kind of do a personalized inventory and then decide where the trade-offs need to be made. Absolutely. And so tell us a little bit about as far as some of those modalities. It was really interesting to hear about the acupuncture and the salivary influence, and what's a double influence of that, again, the synergy of using not just food as medicine, but preventative or integrative medicine, is that not only can you treat the symptom, but you can treat other symptoms or prevent other symptoms that have yet to rear their head. And so I don't know if that resonates with you, but that idea of acupuncture helping with salivary secretion, you know, instead of giving that patient that Zofran or that anti-nausea drug, the acupuncture will help with the saliva, will help with the nausea, and also that may help with their stress response, which was driving fatigue or insomnia. And so we get this myriad of this full spectrum with integrative therapies instead of that single focus drug therapy response.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, and I'm actually in the process of writing a book with my wife, Allison Jeffries, and the book's called Anti-Cancer Living, and in there we put this all together in what we call the mix of six, and, you know, we'll get into the deeper into this discussion, but the areas of love and support, stress, appropriate sleep habits, diet, exercise, reducing environmental toxins, those being the six areas. And there is evidence that there is synergy between them. So as an example, there was a paper published actually just a few weeks ago showing that individuals who were in this experiment, who were fed a healthy diet, you know, in the lab, if they had excess amount of chronic stress in their life, their body responded to that food comparable to somebody who ate a unhealthy diet who didn't have stress in their life. So meaning that chronic stress decreased the beneficial effects of that healthy meal. So, you know, if you don't have – the more things that you have in place, not only will you ultimately have better outcomes, but it will also be easier to engage in all of these other areas. So the example with acupuncture, we know that acupuncture can decrease nausea. So if you can decrease nausea, then you can have healthier nutrition during cancer treatment. Right. If you have healthier nutrition during cancer treatment, then you're probably going to be less fatigued. If you're less fatigued, then you're probably going to have better sleep habits. And it's this kind of, you know, web effect that everything is interrelated. And just hitting one area with one treatment, whether that's an integrative one or a pharmacological one, isn't going to result in as good an outcome as if you try and tackle multiple areas.
Yeah, the vibration of the web, if you will, can be quite a contagion in the positive side as well. I think that's a beautiful thing. Excellent. So tell me a little bit, I'm sure this may change monthly for you or quarterly or annually as far as what's really getting you the most excited or impassioned as far as a specific intervention. I, of course, understand the synchronicity of the dualities of many elements, but let's look at an intervention that you want listeners to be aware of, or that currently you're looking at delving deeper into for clinical outcomes that has been kind of the most cutting edge or the most exciting to you.
Well, you know, it's going to have to be comprehensive lifestyle change, because, you know, I've been doing a lot of research almost 20 years now at MD Anderson and in this area, and, you know, seeing benefit and publishing benefit from acupuncture, from yoga, from specifically meditation, my colleagues doing, you know, interesting research on modifying exercise or modifying diet. And we're going to start doing some dietary feeding studies. So to modify somebody's diet for, you know, an acute period of time, 2 or 3 weeks, and look at the biological outcomes. But all of that I find, you know, important, but is really not looking and documenting, you know, what can truly transform when an individual engages in ultimately what we would call, you know, a more mindful life, a more engaged life in multiple areas. And, you know, being in oncology now for this amount of time and in this latter part of my career, I really want to focus on documenting for the scientific community and the public at large that there are things that people can do to guaranteed improve your quality of life. But we hypothesize it'll improve also your length of life and decrease the probability of recurrence of disease. And just doing, you know, one or two things is unlikely to really shift those survival curves, as it's called. And, you know, I have a lot of ongoing research in what we could call reductionistic science. One of my colleagues doing really exciting research, Sarah Prinsloo, of doing neurofeedback, so change the electrical activity of the brain and the way brain is processing information, and you can change pain syndromes, for example. That's very exciting research, but but you know, that's not going to change the probability of recurrence of disease. So, you know, I think we need to pursue on both fronts, and where we're going in that area, and we can get into some specifics in the area of comprehensive lifestyle changes. How do we get this to more people? How do we take advantage of where we're going in the virtual world and our electronic world so that we can touch more people with this type of comprehensive training?
And do you find any struggles within the healthcare community or within the general public with something like comprehensive lifestyle as it not being quote unquote sexy, I guess, you know, as far as something that's quick, turmeric or something buzzworthy or something that people can go purchase or grab or sign up for? Do you find that to be, because it is comprehensive, to be overwhelming to the individual, or what do you feel to be the I guess best way to lead people into being inspired by that?
So I think I wanted to go back to your previous question.
Yeah.
We talk about, and then I will answer that one.
Great.
We will talk about mindfulness as a component in the comprehensive lifestyle change study. And if I had to cheat and choose one of the modalities, to answer your question, dominant one, I would choose mindfulness because, mindfulness can lead you to eat better. It can lead you to exercise. It can lead you to engage in social support. And I think that so little attention has been made to mindfulness. But the only reason I would say that is because Lorenzo and I are both stubborn about the synergy of behaviors. And I don't think we'll go back to a dietary intervention only or an exercise intervention
sure.
only. But we might settle on, you know, if you can have a mindfulness program that will then trickle down to all the other behaviors, which are, yes, it's very overwhelming. I think that we as interventionists struggle ourselves to be role models, and but that's part of the beauty of the process. You don't set a goal and get there. You develop a new way of constantly trying to embed your own self and your health, and it's an iterative process. And I think that although that's overwhelming, it's also inspiring because you can always improve and always know that you're going to have times where you're not doing so well and when you relapse, and it's just a constant opportunity to overcome these barriers and to know that they're shared barriers. So I hope that makes lifestyle change a little less overwhelming to know
that it is
hard, and especially when you're trying to work on all sorts of behaviors at the same time. But it's a very hopeful process.
And I think that's a good thing. No, I think that's great to acknowledge, Robin, because right, mindfulness leads you into this process or wheel, if you will, and it's also the connecting link. And as you delve deeper, mindfulness likely is important to maintain. We know with diet therapies, there's a concept called orthorexia, which is fear of food in general, not necessarily anorexia as far as caloric restriction, But anytime we start to tailor and want to get better and human condition, likely those that are type A cancer survivors are wanting to do everything perfect and be extremely motivated and check off all these boxes at the same time. And I would imagine that that mindfulness element of rechecking in on that personalized inventory, if you will, would help to reset that stress response from overdriving, I guess, in the process of healing.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. And tell me, so to go, because a lot of the listeners are very food-oriented and food is medicine-focused, within the diet elements of, and we're going to talk specific about the Comp Life study in a moment, but within any research that you guys have participated in or seen, what do you, I would like an answer from both of you. What do you guys feel are the most influential drivers, or if listeners could eliminate one thing from their diet, what would it be? And then what are also the most influential solution elements or treatments or interventions that you think would be important to include per day?
So, you know, the evidence is really strong and stronger and continues every day to mount that there is no magic diet, there is no magic ingredient, that it's about a dietary pattern. It's a general pattern that we want to be following for the majority of the time, and people may deviate here and there from that basic pattern. And a deviation here and there is of course not going to be harmful. The reality of the American situation following the standard American diet, the SAD diet, is that that dietary pattern is one that causes disease. So, you know, this dietary pattern, you know, luckily even the USDA has acknowledged what that dietary pattern should look like. And simplistically, the majority of your plate should be filled with things from the plant world. And the minority with things from the animal world. So, you know, animals provide an easy and good source of protein, but there's also wonderful proteins that can come from the plant world as well. So if you were to mix, you know, the, say, quarter or third of your plate that we need of protein, and some of it from animals and some of it from plants, then you're really talking about three quarters, if not more, of your plate coming from the plant world. And that's really what the USDA now recommends. And what should be eliminated from the plate are, you know, what you could call health depleting foods. And in particular, these foods that result in spikes in glucose, and that leads to spikes in insulin, which is, of course, a risk factor for diabetes. And what are the key drivers of that? Well, if you were to pick one ingredient, that one ingredient would be sugar. And sugar in all of its wonderful forms that we as a nation have invented, whether that's, you know, inverted sugar and dextrose and maltose and, you know, all the different kinds of sugars. And that includes the refined carbs, which, of course, is, you know, white rice and white flour, and of course the white potato not being, you know, shouldn't be classified as a vegetable on your plate, even though it technically is. So that's, you know, in a probably longer statement, but, you know, sugar is been shown in multiple epidemiological studies to be linked with cancer, with heart disease, with diabetes, and with Alzheimer's. So we really need to remove it from the diet, as the American Heart Association, the CDC, and the WHO all recommend.
Yes. And how about you, Robin?
I would say, just knowing that the women in our program, each of them comes to us with a major weakness. You know, soon after they begin working with us, they confess, oh, I eat bread all the time. Or and yes, it is often sugar. But it's surprising that is not is not 100% of the time the major weakness. And sometimes it's fried foods and I just think that the answer to your question has to be a tailored one, because
determining that Achilles heel, if you will.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because it's always one thing or one group of, genre of food items that is a driving factor in the relapses and the barriers and the being overwhelmed. And, I'm not a dietitian, but if I was, I would turn this into a game, for people who really want to eat biscuits every day. There are tons of recipes where the base of the biscuit is made out of squash. And there are so many interesting and creative solutions. And I think that each person's Achilles heel should be very targeted in a fun and creative way, and think about substitutions. Yes, we are a sugar indulgent society, and there's other ways we can treat ourselves. And like what you call mindful indulgences, they don't have to be made up of sugar. And I think that finding each person's weakness, which will then lead to a solution tailored for that person, is what we should do.
I think that's awesome. And it's interesting that you are going to engage in some acute feeding studies, as you mentioned, a 2 to 3 week period. And I would anticipate you may see things like C-reactive protein or insulin growth factor by regulating their glycemic index and varied outcomes. But I agree wholeheartedly that in order to make this a lifestyle change and actually work with a patient to become a survivor and thrive in their health is exactly that element of understanding how cravings influence them and what is driving them to fall off and how they can maintain within flavor profiles that they desire and start to shift their palate to crave the nourishing food. So that's, I think, a huge piece of the puzzle for certain. So let's talk a little bit about how we all cross paths and tell listeners about the research study that brought us together. So I'll give you my version and then I'll let you guys add anything. And so I actually was tabling at the Urban Harvest Farmers Market, and I was making newsletters that were focused on food as medicine. And this was in my transition out of running the physician's practice group that I was doing for the first 4 years of my career. And I believe this was the fall, because October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I had a newsletter with sweet potato as the vegetable focus, and it talked about its health benefits, the carotenoids, different forms of astaxanthin and antioxidants, and all this high-level information on the food as medicine and how it could heal the body. And then on the back end was three elements to avoid. I believe it was like xenoestrogens and BPA. I think I had environmental estrogenic compounds that can be consumed in your food or your cosmetics. And also three foods that help you to combat or fight against estrogen dominance in the body. So it was things like I3Cs, which was in your Brussels sprout, broccoli, cauliflower family. It was omega-3 fatty acids to reduce inflammation and inflammatory processes, and a high fiber diet to help the colon in the detox process. And then some recipes to support that. And so I think what had happened was, I believe, I'm not sure which was first or second, but I had met Dr. Lorenzo Cohen while I was tabling. Monica Pope, who is a chef in the Houston area and has been on Top Chef Masters and pretty renowned, brought Lorenzo over to me and said, "You gotta listen to Allie talk about butter." And because Monica, to like a dietitian, you know, any chef to like a dietitian, I think, is a big step, because I think that chefs perceive dietitians to be flavorless and, you know, say everything low fat and low fun. So I started talking about butter because Monica had kind of bought in into that of, oh, well, Allie talks about how food can be medicine, and these are like really cool wild foods and nourishing traditional foods, not these factory enhanced foods. And so I talked about butter and the conjugated linoleic acids and grass fed and this and that, and went on my way. And then at some other point, I think Robin got my newsletter on the sweet potatoes and breast cancer connection. And I think it was Robin, you reached out to me first, right?
Yes. Yes, I was shopping at the farmer's market, and when I saw you tabling and your materials, I just knew it was divine intervention. We had been on the search for someone to help us for a long time, and it's really difficult to find a dietitian aligned with our philosophy, surprisingly. And so, yes, that was the connection. Thank you, Urban Harvest.
Yes. And so how many months had you all, I know the foundation, how about actually let's discuss the foundation of the study and the element of anti-cancer, the book, and how that kind of drove the principles of the study, and then how far along you were when we met at that point.
So I think it was about 6 years ago that I met David Servan-Schreiber, who wrote this wonderful book called Anti-Cancer. He subsequently lost his life to cancer, but lived for almost 20 years after a diagnosis of a brain tumor that he was told by all doctors that he would not be living certainly that long. And in this book, he really lays out all of the evidence that I had known about in terms of diet, exercise, environment, love and support, that were on different in different books, in different forms, in different articles. And David put it together in such a compelling and easily readable way for the lay public
and hopeful.
And yes. Very hopeful, you know, giving people, you know, things that they could do to modify their outcomes, and very evidence-based and sharing the science. And so we had him come and visit MD Anderson to give, you know, a keynote talk, and he gave a public lecture. And we kind of decided that evening with some local and non-local philanthropists that, you know, what was really missing and the missing link in this area was a definitive clinical trial showing that if you modify the risk factors, you modify the outcomes. So the chair of breast medical oncology at that time, Dr. Gabriel Hortabaji, very supportive of this whole area of lifestyle, but his common refrain would be when I would share articles with him, yes, it is true that the women in the study who ate more vegetables lived longer, but this is a correlative study, and association does not determine causation.
Right.
You need
right.
to manipulate the factors. So that means a clinical trial. So we, luckily David, due to the popularity of his book and his book tours, already had, you know, a wonderful following, so to speak. So we were able to, through philanthropy, raise a tremendous amount of money to embark on what we call the comprehensive lifestyle change study. We've now been running this study, Robin, for 3 years or so. Focus specifically on women with breast cancer who are starting the radiation phase of their treatment, and they get very intensive counseling during their 6 weeks of radiation, 2 hours a week with the dietary counselor, 2 hours with their exercise coach, 2 hours with the mind-body coach, and then 1 hour with the behavioral counselor, who will continue the behavioral counseling weekly for 6 months. And then monthly for the subsequent 6 months. So a total of around 70 hours of counseling across the course of 12 months, being very intensive for those first 6 weeks to get people launched.
Awesome. And so when you guys had the foundation developed, and I came in to help to develop the curriculum for nutrition, and there was an element of the didactic counseling, one-on-one education, as well as a food lab, if you will, where we had 6 sessions developed of each, both the counseling education and which that had concepts, as well as checking in on their food journaling, and then ensuring that we're educating the next layer, which was maybe starting with label lingo, which then pushed further into talking about fiber and strategic goal setting to complete each educational counseling session. So they had quote unquote homework and performance and accountability. And then the food lab had the element, which was really neat as far as connecting the dots of if the recommendation was to use leafy greens and play with different nutrient-dense leafy greens, then we would actually teach them how to massage kale in the food lab, or connecting the dots of if the recommendation was to, now that you're having a salad and you're at your 7 to 11 servings of vegetables and fruits a day, now we want you to play with homemade dressings versus store-bought dressings so you can get your olive oil intake up to help within that Mediterranean diet recommendation. And so a session on making salad dressings from scratch. And so that synergy, I think, connection of that lab as well as educational component was a really unique attribute in that first six-week program.
Yes, and in each of the components and each of the behavioral domains, we do that. It's very experiential and hands-on. They exercise every day with exercise coach. The nutrition was split up into dominantly didactic and dominantly experiential because of the nature of cooking and understanding of the effects of what you're eating.
And over time, we've shifted a bit, and we're very thankful for Ali, for you getting us launched with this curriculum. And then as you start working with the patients, what became clear was partly because we were trying to cover so much material in a short period of time, and to make it in some sense more fun, engaging. And that concept of sharing, right, a really important part, and we'll get to this further on, is the therapeutic alliance that they're forming and the trust that they're getting from all four of these wonderful women who are trying to help transform the patient's life. And one wonderful way that we, of course, as a society do this is by sharing a meal. And so actually in every session that they work with the dietitian, there is some type of a preparation of a meal
and snack or
so one time a week.
Beautiful.
It's a bit more in depth, but then on the other time of the week, a little more didactic. But they'll always do, they'll prepare a snack, they'll prepare a wonderful blended vegetable beverage.
And it's a great opportunity to tailor to that person's skill set and needs and desires.
And barriers,
in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's about, knife technique. Sometimes it's about how you wash produce differently. And for every patient, we meet them where they want to be or where they are in the kitchen. And it's not, the dietitian just cooking for them necessarily. It's very hands-on and very tailored. And it's also an opportunity for them to bring family members or friends.
Yes.
They're open. We're open. The kitchen is a place for social support and mindful eating and sharing what we learn and what we want to eat with others. So that's been a really great opportunity. Sometimes their kids come or their husbands.
That's excellent. And I think that all too often the perspective is that eating is going to be unpleasant. And I think that's more associated with chemotherapy during cancer care. But it can be even so with radiation therapy. And also that there's just only going to be this reductionist what not to do. Don't do, don't do, don't do. Eliminate, eliminate, eliminate for the patient experience from their nutrition care team. And so I think it's really fabulous that really drives home that abundance principle, if you will, by actually bringing the meal or the snack or the food into the conversation of food. I think that probably resonates very strongly. It's a really excellent, unique attribute of that. Awesome. So tell me a little bit. So we talked about the length of the study is 12 months. There's the intensive 6-week starting point, and you talked about the different modalities. Tell me about the screening process and the diagnosis.
So these are stage two or three breast cancer, and specifically choosing cancers for which, the prognosis isn't exceptional compared to if you're DCIS or stage one, but still a chance where these lifestyle changes could modify outcomes. Importantly, they need to not be following the American Institute for Cancer Research guidelines for diet or physical activity, and they need to have a body mass index and a measure, the medical measurement of weight that puts you in the overweight range. So not following the recommendations for healthy eating, exercise, a BMI of 25 or above, and or not engaging in regular stress management behavior. So you need to not meet two of those three, diet, exercise, and stress management, and having a BMI of over 25. And then these women are eligible.
And to assess the stress management, does that have to be a actual program that they're participating in, or do they take a survey assessing how they perceive stress? Is prayer included in that as a formality, or how is that element assessed?
So prayer is not included. I mean, we don't ask them specifically about their prayer, but we ask them in general, what are your stress management techniques? And like everything else, it's tailored. If someone perceives prayer as a stress management technique, then that's how we perceive it.
And they'd be needing to, you know, say that they engage in that on a regular routine basis.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, you know, with those three criteria, it's pretty rare that we don't include somebody. So when we're screening patients, it's rare that patients fulfill two of the three categories.
Sure. Okay.
Which is unfortunate, but that's just the reality of our society.
And how many active participants do you have today?
Well, we've recruited over 60 of the 160 that we'll need.
Okay. Wow. And then what's the accountability post the year? So you've had now, you're in the third year of active. And so there's, so go ahead.
Recruiting patients for 3.5 years.
Okay. And so some have completed that first year?
Correct.
Yeah, many have gone through the full program now.
And are they being monitored quarterly, or they're just checking in more casually, or?
So we have formal assessments, at the beginning, the end of radiation, 3, 6, 12 months.
Do you mean after the 12 months?
Right. Yep. Yeah. After the 12 months.
So after the 12 months, it's
passive through maintenance. Medical records.
Yep. Okay.
No, and then every 12 months we do, I think we months we do a big formal assessment, then at 24 months they come in, they do exercise testing, and they complete food recalls.
Yes.
And all that kind
Yes, and when they come in for their follow-up appointments, for their clinical follow-up appointments, we see them as well. We kind of piggyback off of their clinical follow-ups.
Yeah, we do what would be called booster sessions at every clinic visit. They'll meet with all four of their counselors.
Okay, excellent. And so tell me about some of the Dr. Cohen, you referenced that correlation is not causation, and I think that's a classic term that can be very frustrating within research in general. What are some of the assessment measures that you're using to justify the interventions made?
So, you know, the primary outcome is recurrence of disease. So, you know, we're tracking that over time, but then we're measuring a number of different things. We're taking blood samples where we're going to be analyzing inflammatory markers, immunological markers, hormone regulation, insulin glucose balance, antioxidant levels, omega-3, omega-6 fatty acid ratio. We're going to be measuring something that's called circulating tumor cells. So, you know, these micro cancer cells that could be floating in the body. We're collecting fecal samples, which is going to measure the microbiome, with the hypothesis that people engaging in healthy living are going to have increased biodiversity, in particular of the healthy microbes. We're measuring are we doing heart rate variability, which is a measure of the balance between the sympathetic, which is the fight or flight drive, versus the parasympathetic, which is the calm, relaxing tone of our bodies.
We also look at bone density, fitness tests like strength measures, and all sorts of psychometric questionnaires. So people tell us over time their depression levels, fatigue, how well they sleep. And we also have them wear sophisticated monitors like ActiWatches. I don't know if everyone's familiar with that, but it's a step counter, and we have them wear that for 5 days at a time at each time point. And then we do the phone interviews to get a dietary recall for the previous 24 hours. So there's a whole slew of assessments, and that's one of the things that makes this study unique.
And very importantly, trying to tap into more of what we call the kind of psycho-spiritual measures, things like benefit finding, you know, the ability to find meaning in illness, purpose in life, aspects of mindfulness, which we believe will improve over time for the women in the intervention.
We also have to take as much as we can and measure their compliance with these behaviors. So we look at gym attendance. We try to get their exercise and mind-body practice logs. And that is a challenge, but an important part of the data collection. And then we can see if people who engage in these behaviors more are more successful.
It's really remarkable, just like the layering of the interventions themselves. It sounds as the assessments are just as dynamic, having the biometrics, having the accountability trackers, having the performance, if you will, or habitual behavior. Really, really, that must be fun for you to weed through, Robin, as far as collection. So tell me, actually, that's a great transition. What are some of the barriers that you both have faced with this particular research study?
Well, you know, I'll start with the barriers in actually launching it is that, you know, a lot of my colleagues, both the medical side and importantly, my behavioral science colleagues were saying, you know, this is too much, you know, this is too intense. People aren't going to do it. You know, why do you have to do so much all at once? Lorenzo's too extreme. You know, only you could do this kind of an intervention. And, you know, I kindly acknowledge that maybe they're right, but that's why it's called an experiment and we need to try it.
Sure.
Because from my point of view, if we don't do something extreme, these women are going to die of their cancer.
Yeah.
They have high risk factor for recurrence of disease based on their weight and unhealthy behaviors. So something pretty big has to happen. And just getting them to eat, two more servings of fruits and vegetables a day isn't that big thing. Just having them reduce their weight, I do not think that's going to work, even though the National Cancer Institute's invested over $14 million in doing a study just like that. Let's reduce women's weight by on average 11%. And it doesn't really matter how they reduce their weight. Obviously, it'll be through diet and exercise, but it doesn't matter what diet they do. As long as they lose 11% of their body weight, I don't think that's going to be enough. So, you know, that's really been one of the barriers, that it's just too much and the women aren't going to do it.
Well, and with weight loss, unfortunately, I think the issue is all too often we see that it's not sustained. And so a study such as that, that's just tracking a quantitative value to deem success, likely will not hold up as far as longevity and disease prevention.
Yes, because it's only one piece of a big puzzle.
Right, right, absolutely. And how about you, Robin? What is your primary barrier?
I don't want to kill the mood, but it was a huge barrier when we were kind of planning out how we were going to recruit participants, the wording, how to approach somebody in the waiting room where they were going to be prepped for radiation for daily treatment for 6 weeks, you know, how to ask them, will you stay here after your treatment for 2 to 3 hours a day for the majority of the week? So that was pretty daunting, trying to figure out a way to sell this and to make it something that people see the value in. And also, most importantly, we're talking about a behavior modification that makes people question everything they have done leading up to,
right,
not only today, but their their primary cancer diagnosis. And I have never seen what Lorenzo and I both suspected, people be defensive or think that we told them that we're causing their cancer. But it's a very logical conclusion. Someone might feel guilty. We do see a little bit of guilt as to not being compliant with the intervention, but we don't see people who are disappointed in themselves or think that they caused this. We just see people who are ready to solve this problem and tackle whatever they can do to get better. And I think that was a huge barrier for us as behavioral scientists and health promotion professionals to approach people and kind of give them the education that is suggesting that they have not been treating themselves or their health to the best of their ability in a way that makes them feel hopeful
and empowered.
I'm not going to take the credit. I think it's the team of people that we have, wonderful motivational interviewing techniques and social support they get from their practitioners. It's not a patient-practitioner relationship. It's patient-practitioners as a team, and they feel this massive support and don't feel like we are saying anything to that effect. But I know that outside of this study that I have encountered people who would feel like you're blaming them or accusing them. And I just think that that is such a wonderful thing about not only our program, but this institution engenders people who want to be part of research and want to be part of improving healthcare. This should be standard of care. Diet and exercise are just as relevant as conventional treatment, or more relevant. And to that effect, another barrier is telling people that they should eat a certain way and then them having issues finding healthy food.
Access, sure.
In our own cafeterias and our own food stores on site. And trying to explain why what we are asking them to do goes above and beyond what's easy. And we've been doing that over all sorts of budgets. Some people are on food stamps, and we have been able to work with them and figure out a way to get them access to the best foods. So that's another important barrier.
And that goes back to meeting them where they're at, of course. You know, always good, better, best approaches to their food selection.
And we were criticized heavily that we were going to get higher income, unemployed
white women,
mm-hmm. and that could not be further from the truth. We have had the full spectrum, and actually most of our women are employed, and some of them have, you know, kept up almost full-time hours and been able to manage our study and have actually thanked us and said that it has helped them in every other aspect of their lives. And we've had people with no transportation find a way. So it's just been remarkable.
A flip side to the barrier question, and an important one to note, I think, for the audience is where we didn't have barriers. And that was with the radiation oncologists and the medical oncologists. They are desperate for this kind of a study because their patients ask them all the time,
sure.
Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I change my diet? Is stress going to cause my cancer to come back? And if you look at the epidemiological data, it suggests, yes, you need to do something. You need to modify your diet. You need to modify your stress. You need to lose weight. You need to start exercising. But they can't say that with a clear scientific prescriptive in a manner that's clear, scientific, and prescriptive because the data isn't there to support it from a clinical trial. So, you know, when we came in and first described this clinical trial to the radiation oncologist, not only do they welcome us with open arms, they also say, can we have this program for ourselves? Because they want to engage in healthy lifestyle and to have all the coaching that we're providing to the women. So, you know, hopefully one day this is available to everyone and ideally before you have a diagnosis of cancer, because we believe it'll decrease your risk in the first place.
And that's all too true, you know, both ends of the spectrum of the acute care model in allopathic medicine, that oncologist only has 3 to 5 minutes. You know, it's the techs that are doing most of the engagement within that patient. And so within that 3 to 5 minutes, there just isn't ample time or resources for them to provide the opportunity for the patient to make those types of lifestyle interventions. And so having that referral onward where they can do those 2 to 3 hour intensive sessions and actually be able to share their stories so their practitioners can tailor and customize and understand and work with them is probably where we will see this big picture outcome and change, because we all know that information or a handout could be as good as the dust it collects if it just sits on your table. You know, it's really the connection of the dots, if you will, of how this information becomes best practice and becomes day-to-day functionality. And then the other end of the spectrum of the oncologist participating, I absolutely agree too. There's only more and more research we see on healthcare practitioners and how unwell they are. And it's a disappointing, you know, perspective and reality that we all face, the long-term hours and unfortunately the rise in suicide rates we've been seeing with physicians continues to rise because of not having that mental care, that stress reduction therapy, and also probably nourishing diets and all of these pieces, yoga, meditation. Absolutely. So tell me real quick about some of the successes seen, if there's a good anecdotal story or experiential, what is the aha moment or the warm fuzzy feeling, if you will, that on your drive home makes you know that you're doing the right thing?
So let me preface this, and then I'll pass it off to Robin, who has more intimate knowledge of each of these wonderful women making true, true life transformations in their lives. That we recently had a paper accepted for publication, which is essentially the design of the study where we, you know, describe actually, you know, a part of what we've just described to you. And then what we call the patient experience. So we did exit interviews with the first six patients to kind of see what was going on. Did we need to change anything? And now on an ongoing basis, we do a kind of exit interview at the 6 week intensive part. And then again, a more formal one at the 12 month time point. So we share in this peer-reviewed journal publication some of the patient's stories, and it's really incredible. We review these patients on a weekly basis, and the stories that I hear from these four wonderful counselors, you know, literally, you know, bring tears to my eyes every week of you know, the bravery and the change that people are really making.
Excellent.
Okay. So I want to read a couple of quotes from our wonderful ladies. And then, Allie, if you have questions about them, just let me know.
Sure. Go ahead.
So this is one from one of our early on participants. And actually, we failed to mention something really important. Some of our colleagues were so worried about how realistic this program was. We were asked to have the first six participants be kind of tentative pilot participants, because no one was sure if this was actually feasible and people would really commit to the program. And so the first six participants at first were kind of a pilot study. And so this is one of those six. I don't know if anyone has ever felt like this, to have so many questions, but the answers are trapped in you. That's how I've felt for so long. Well, I've come to realize through meditation and deep relaxation that my answers are flowing. I can honestly say that I've never been in such deep thought about my life. And knowing her and knowing what she is talking about, she's not talking about these answers that have been trapped in her since her illness or her cancer diagnosis. She started dealing with things that she had never dealt with, you know, for decades. And we see that a lot, people coming to terms with problems that they didn't know they even had until they started this program and took a better look at themselves.
Wow.
And yes, and another one, I know the changes to my diet, the tracking, the talks with the counselor strengthened me beyond measure, and I feel that my continued adherence to this program is no longer just following a plan. I've changed my lifestyle for the better, and you all had a hand in it. And I think that this paints such a good picture of this is not a prescription. This is a way of life. It's not just a plan. It is a new strategy for dealing with these, lifestyle barriers and successes.
And one of the key aspects that I think is missing from a lot of lifestyle change studies is that area of mindfulness and that area of stress management, because chronic stress and the relapses that people experience in behavior change, whether that's trying to modify your diet or eliminate an addictive substance from your life, chronic stress is a key trigger. And the whole emotional side that we have, an emotional, unhealthy emotional relationships we have with food. And this is something that the behavioral counselor has been so critical in trying to modify those relationships. It is really hope that we're providing to these patients. One patient said, "It's been 24 years since I've taken care of myself, and now they have given back all of the tools I needed to get back to normal. The support and learning from all of you means so much." And then just this one last quote, which kind of addresses that very sensitive issue that I'm glad Robin raised of the issue of blame and whether, by saying if you make these lifestyle changes, you can improve outcomes means that you brought this on. And, we're talking about risk reduction here. And of course, there's no promises. But this isn't actually an issue for patients. I typically don't hear this as an issue coming from patients. It's often an issue you hear coming from the professional medical population because they're very concerned with this concept of blame. And patients in general, don't want to put everyone in that category, don't have that issue. And this one patient concludes by saying, "I want to just first say that I'm so honored to be part of this life-changing program. It is amazing. Just think, we can be instrumental in changing the way cancer is viewed and treated for years to come."
That's awesome. Very empowering. Very empowering. And I think that connecting all of these pieces, as you mentioned, this mindfulness, I think, is so strongly integrated in not just successful outcomes and sustainability, but in the actual physiological, biochemical shifts within the body. And a lot of that's overlooked. I know you mentioned, Dr. Cohen, earlier on the element of stress on the heart rate and the sympathetic nervous system and collecting stool samples, I think you said, with your participants to look at the microbiome. And I'm really intrigued to see the changes there because up-to-date research is actually showing beyond the influence of prebiotic fibrous compounds and bacteria colonization that markers such as secretory IgA, which is an inflammatory marker in the bowel, and even the amount of bifidobacteria, as well as resistant bacterial strains and colonies, all can shift based on stress response. And so that element of that beyond what's coming in and beyond how we are thriving the GI tract with our probiotic-rich foods or eating those fibers that can be fermented, it's the influence of mindfulness and stress response that can either sterilize the GI tract, allowing those pathogens to set up camp, or promote that synergistic influence that we're striving for. And so the behavior is maybe, we could say, only as good as the intention or the perspective of the relationship of the behavior of the individual. So I think that that's a huge, huge piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, a good metaphor would be an orchestra. If a section of the orchestra is out of tune or they don't know that piece, things aren't going to sound as good. And if, there's just one or two people out of tune, you're going to notice that as well. So, everything needs to be working together properly to create, the perfect harmony.
Absolutely. So finally, well, I have one final question after this, which I have to ask all my guests, but for the final topic related question, so where do you guys see cancer care going, and what's your, following the completion of this study, what's next on your plate as far as action plans and goals for the future?
So I think, where do I see cancer care going? I think we actually are going to see a lot more delving into the cells and into genes. And we didn't really get into this, but, you know, all of these lifestyle areas, what at the beginning I was calling the mix of six, they influence all the way down to our genes and gene expression and multiple cancer-related pathways and targets. But for now, you know, as a medical world, we're really going to be continuing down the pharmaceutical path. I am hopeful that as data from our group emerges, as well as others around the country and world looking at behavior, that prevention will be prioritized a bit more, and incorporating lifestyle change alongside conventional care will also be prioritized, not in place of, but in addition to. So why not, you know, harness everything that we can to improve cancer outcomes? Clinically, you know, and research-wise, where we're going next is how can we get this to more people? How can we harness existing technologies and be on the cutting edge of future technologies to be able to take this type of comprehensive lifestyle training right into somebody's living room so they don't have to, you know, come into the med center 7 hours a week for 6 weeks, which is definitely a challenge. And again, moving it into the prevention perspective, you know, we shouldn't teach these people these lifestyle changes after they're diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. Let's prevent that life-threatening illness in the first place.
Absolutely. And how about for you, Robin?
I think that a lot of why reductionistic research became such a big thing is because of our limited ways of measuring what brought about the impact and what exactly, you know, caused the change. And I think that statistical methodologies have improved such that we can assess the combined effects of different behaviors. And I think that that is where research is going, being able to reassess, you know, how does synergy actually work, and how can we measure that? And I think that that it was a very unfortunate conclusion that had been made in the past, that reductionistic research is warranted, that single behavior interventions are more effective because we didn't know how to measure multiple behavior interventions. And I think that that is going away, and that's an old era, and people are realizing that we can look at things in a much more sophisticated, holistic point of view, not only theoretically, but also statistically. And that's something that I personally am working on in my PhD, and something that I think is driving policy and health promotion going forward.
Excellent. And my listeners are relatively familiar with this concept of epigenetics, and that's what we've alluded to in these great six that influence the DNA, if you will. And that's the element that I love to leave my listeners with, is that empowerment of, we can no longer take our hands off the driver's wheel of the vehicle of our body and say it's just bad genes. I know that in anti-cancer, David pulls a research study that really identifies that nature versus nurture, where they looked at cancer research for adopted children versus their biological parent. And I reference that all the time, you know, so that to clients when they come to me saying, well, it's genetic. I have bad genes. And all too often we feel doomed by them versus really understanding those intricacies of the ability of our genes to turn on and off like light switches by those kinase responses, and how those can tie into these great lifestyle factors. So, excellent. Lastly, before I let you guys go, tell me what you had to eat yesterday. I never give you the heads up on that. But so, Dr. Cohen, tell listeners what you had to eat yesterday, and then we'll head out, and I'll have you guys stick around for some closing notes, but I'll close the episode after that.
Well, that's a great question. A and you can, I can be caught on any day because, as everyone says, I'm too extreme. So for breakfast, I had a gluten-free piece of toast with some miso spread on it, and then some hummus with olive oil and paprika and a side of kale, you know, just chopped up sautéed kale with garlic and olive oil. Lunch, what did I have for lunch? I know for dinner we went and celebrated at a friend's house, and I actually I hadn't made veggie burgers before because I don't really, you know, believe in reformulating food to match some food that I don't necessarily support, because we know there's a link between beef consumption and colon cancer.
See, I'm all about that. You can do that.
Lentil patty.
You know, this a veggie burger that accompanied you know, a kale salad and a pea sprout salad. What were some of the other dishes? I don't know. It was all super delicious and all anti-cancer foods.
Colorful and okay. Excellent. And Robin, how about you fill in? What was your lunch yesterday? Just to get the middle
this
of it.
Very atypical because I was on the road yesterday. But I was in Austin, and I had a breakfast of sweet potato, pepper, and pumpkin seed whole wheat tacos, and black beans and brown rice. And I gave my 8.5-month-old black beans and brown rice for the first time. So that was exciting.
Oh.
And then I had a juice that was a daily greens juice that was lemonade and cayenne. And the only reason I bring up the juice is because the founder of the company, Daily Greens, actually used juicing whole fruits and vegetables, cold pressing, to help in her cancer recovery. And actually she had sponsored an event that my brother-in-law was hosting in Austin for his artwork, and that's why I ended up with the juice. And I was so glad to hear the story of how she had shared her recipes and her personal lifestyle change with the world through her new product.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me, both Dr. Lorenzo Cohen and Robin, and so thrilled to have been a part of the research study and development of the nutrition and food as medicine protocol. And I am extremely excited to be able to experience and watch the outcomes and support you guys along the way in best way I can. Thanks.
Thank you, Allie.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Naturally Nourished podcast. Visit our blog at alliemillerrd.com for recipes, wellness tips, and food as medicine meal plans. Connect with Allie and Carly at alliemillerrd on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Until next time, stay nourished and be well.